It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Okay. I'm Lena Kafka. I'm an anarchist from Pittsburgh, and I've been involved with the Filler Veen and Distro Collective for a couple years now. I've been involved in various student organizations and student organizing, as well as like workplace organizing among kitchens and really just community organizing around all of Pittsburgh for probably 7 or 8 years now.
All right, I'm Elias. I've lived in Pittsburgh my whole life. I have done a lot of student organizing as well as some community organizing around various.
I'm Vince. I'm also from Filler. I'm here to be the filler person that goes like, yeah, I like that.
I'm Amanda, and I don't really know why I'm here.
And that's the Filler Collective, as well as another comrade from the info shop listening in.
Okay, let's start with some questions. The first question is, how do you define gender?
There's a lot of different ways to define gender, many of which will probably be contradictory and vary based upon what philosophical background you take. And that's led to a lot of arguments within like gender nihilists, to how they define it. But generally, we see gender as an apparatus of governance, as in it's a means of separating and dividing people based upon body type, culture, economic background, phenotypes, secondary sex characteristics, and whatnot. And that this apparatus is the means of categorizing people and limiting them and dividing them into set categories as a means to make them more easily controlled and governable, and to make the process of production and work flow smoother by dividing people into set roles. And this is a historical process that's from the dawn of civilization, or like the dawn of class society, because gender was the first class separating people, the different classes of people, whether it be like male, female, man, woman, or whatever terminology was used in like there, say the beginning. And this apparatus overlaps with various other apparatuses, and
overlaps with various other apparatuses
to like
construct what we would, some would call the hierarchy, or others might just say, you know,
yeah,
the systems of domination which are playing our lives.
Yeah, gender's like overlapping with other networks of governance to perform specific roles of governance. At least that's how we would define gender.
How have identity politics and various waves of feminism approached the question of gender?
So, for waves of feminism, I can't really say each specific wave, how they define it, because there are various different ideologies among each wave. Most recently, we would say like the radical feminist wave of the 70s would define gender more along the aspects of like defining gender as gender is to sex, or sex is the biological construct of gender. So feminists from the 70s, or like radical feminists now, would define it as just biological essentialism. Gender is purely the divide between like what genitalia people have. Well, earlier waves would define it as more along the lines of biology with like economics, biology with like the social role. To counter that, there's also like Monique Wittig from the 1970s, 1980s, who also falls along radical feminism. but also does not define gender based upon biology. It defines gender as a social role, purely. That there is no, like, natural form of gender. As for how identity politics today would define gender, again, it would vary based upon who you ask, because identity politics just varies based on whoever you ask and how they interpret it and what old heads told them what to think. Gender today would be more just, like, gender identity, or, like, gender under identity politics today would just be, like, gender identity. Gender is your own personal understanding of how you relate to, like, networks of power and the apparatuses of governance and how you define yourself. It's more of, like, the personalized view of, a personalized view of gender rather than a structural view of gender. As gender as something innate, and gender as something as part of you, not gender as something that is put upon you, or the way that power categorizes you and classifies you.
Okay, so this leads us to the next question, which is, what is gender nihilism?
Gender nihilism is sort of an ideology, and yet tries not to be an ideology. That came out of post-structuralist thought and, like, radical feminist thought, combining post-structuralist understanding of society and post-structuralist understanding of how governance and history have developed, with the combination of radical feminist gender abolition, while trying to strip away the radical feminist parts of gender abolition. So far as that, like, radical feminists see gender abolition as purely ending, like, gender distinction and making it based purely upon biology, while gender nihilist gender abolition is an attempt to strip it away and strip away the naturalism of gender and say that gender and sex are the same categories and that you can't abolish one without the other and that they're inherently tied together.
There's some quote marks around, like, biology
and, yeah,
the radical feminist understanding of the matter.
And there's various radical feminists who would all disagree with each other. But gender nihilism is just a way to go about abolishing gender without setting forward a positive project for what gender abolition would look like. It's just, it's like a refusal of categorization and an attempt to abolish and attack the material base of gender so that people aren't inherently or immediately categorized based upon biology or based upon social roles or norms or how, like, whatever genitalia they are born with and whatever social roles they eventually fulfill later on in life. Gender abolition is a way to get beyond that categorization and a way to break that sense of social and economic governance of gender. Usually doing so through critique of gender, critique of the way the left handles gender, everything about that, and through, like, unintelligibility and just unintelligibility and critique.
Can you elaborate on that last point a little more?
Sure. Gender nihilism sees gender as a means to, like, categorize and understand people, and that understanding of people and the ability to categorize being the same process. So it tries to make people understandable and fit into set categories to make them more easily movable and governable and controllable. In order for, like, to abolish gender is to unintelligible to gender, as in gender cannot categorize somebody or force them to fit into one or so categories. Trying not to quote, but the quote from Aidan Rowe's Gender Nihilism. Gender nihilism designates a kind of radical antagonism at the level of gender identity, a refusal of the injunction to know what one is, to objectify oneself as knowledge, to make oneself known, a persistent no comment to the police who surround us and suffice us to extract a confession. So gender nihilism sees, like, unintelligibility as not being able to be governed, and not being able to be categorized and simplified and forced into specific roles.
And therefore dangerous to the state and the apparatuses of control.
Yeah. Not purely, like, to be unintelligible, but, like, to subvert it, to destroy it, to get underneath it, around it, however we want to conceptualize what abolition means.
So how do you see gender nihilism, this subversion, this unintelligibility you talk about, how do you see that playing out in practice?
That's the question.
We've been arguing about this a lot lately.
Yeah. That's pretty much been our whole last week of discussions with each other, is what does abolition even mean? Because There is no pre-gendered past. Like, it's not that gender has always existed, but if there was a point of society where gender did not exist, we are not aware of it. Because, like, the dawn of written history and the dawn of civilization is, like, the dawn of gender. And there's a whole discussion about primitivism and year zero shit that we could get into, but it's not worth it. It's just, gender did not... Whether or not gender existed before class society is not something to base abolition off of.
I guess there's a number of different projects sort of concerning themselves with gender abolition, and then there's also obviously different responses to these projects within the field of gender abolitionism. Mm-hmm. The concept of gender hacking, which basically comes down to, like, do-it-yourself hormone replacement therapy, is one kind of interesting avenue that obviously you run into a lot of arguments within the gender abolitionist milieu regarding how effective that is, you know, how much does ascribing this kind of, even if it is removed from the normal apparatus of control into sort of like DIY or black market attainment and prescription of these, you know, hormones that you're replacing in yourself, it still is relying upon the kind of chemical signifier as a movement of gender. And that's obviously the critique of it. The other, you know, sort of, I guess, what would be the positive critique, I guess, of it, is that it is this sort of very material and very physical sort of personal ownership of these biocodes, I guess, if you want to call the hormones a biocode. It's a signifier. It's a thing that's going to be placed on you one way or the other, but in this particular case, it would be a sort of very radical attainment and control of those particular expressions of gender, quote-unquote. And then, of course, like I said earlier, the negative critique of that is that we don't want those, we don't want any kind of expression of gender. We want the abolition of gender.
Mm-hmm.
For me, gender abolition or gender nihilism is just the total rejection of all categorization based upon sex or gender, which means literally doing whatever the fuck you want about your gender and rejecting the boxes that, like, society puts you in every way that you can.
And I would agree most closely with Elias, but I see gender abolition as, well, abolition itself as just the removal of the base of it and removal of, like, the effects it has on society. Like, gender abolition has to, like, go for the roots and get the roots of gender out, however we define, like, what the roots are. Like, I see, like, how people are assigned a gender at birth as, like, the first step towards gender abolition is, like, not marking people into a set category at birth. Like, the whole labeling children to one or two categories at birth and buying them things based upon, like, one or two colors that just designated to the gender just sounds like a dystopia. To anybody, like, if you thought of it, like, without preconceived notions of gender, categorizing people from birth and defining what they can and can't do as dystopia. So gender abolition is...
It's literally Brave New World. I mean, that's the plot of Brave New World, just more categories.
Yeah. Abolition would mean that regardless of what you do, what genitalia you have, what phenotypes, how you dress, what culture or economics, or what cultural background, what economic background you come from, does not limit or forcefully categorize you into a limiting role.
So a practice of gender nihilism is becoming doctors and not assigning gender when you help birth children is what I take from this.
It's less so becoming doctors and being able to do that, because, like, you still have to perform the role of being the doctor, and, like, if you don't, like, check that off on, like, the child's birth certificate or whatever, like, you probably get in trouble or fired.
Someone else will check
that. Yeah, off. Someone else will take that place, and then even then you're, like, one of however many, like, doctors involved in that, and just, it's not enough. There needs to be a structural change to it all, not just an individual act.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that there's no such thing as abolition of gender within the confines of the society we live in or capitalism. I think those things contradict absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as for a praxis of gender nihilism, we would have to find ways to break away from the current set system of capitalism, of gender, of civilization, however we want to define it and limit it. And doing so, like, would match very closely to anarchist practice of creating spaces without gender, without hierarchy, without governance and whatnot, all the other great buzzwords that we use. Doing so, like, we would have to create communities and spaces that aren't safe but dangerous to those who want to force governance and force gender upon us. And really, an overall structural and systemic change of the gendered system, or to break away from it in one way or another.
Okay, do any of you have any experience you'd like to share participating in some sort of resistance that was informed by a gender nihilist perspective?
It's a little difficult to, like, map out a practice of gender abolition or gender nihilism in any way, because it hasn't come about. Like, we can theorize all we want, but it's pretty much just playing mind games and, like, thought experiments, basically.
Yes, that's
and, like, yeah, without, like, the actual material change of it all, we have no idea how it's done or what to do. Like, we have experiences, like, trying to make radical spaces and the spaces that we inhabit, not simply as radicals, to be more inclusive, but that itself is not gender nihilism, because all it does is expand and make people, expand the concepts of gender, expands the categories of gender, but does not eliminate gender as its own, or as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's the big gap in gender nihilism, the conflict I have with it, is it's so based in the theoretical. And I would so love to bring it down into reality and into our spaces, but I think we all get in the habit of, expand, like Lena said, expanding the categories of gender and creating more inclusive spaces, but not ridding our spaces of violent gendering in any way, just, like, trying to.
Like, making a space where, like, trans women get to be called their pronouns and their right name without, like, having to hassle or call people out or do any of that shit doesn't abolish gender in any way and doesn't remove the actual power structure between people who have to choose whether or not to follow those rules or, like, if they're just going to continue on following the set hierarchies. I would say there probably are no experiences in practicing gender abolition on, like, a day-to-day basis, simply because gender nihilism doesn't propose any positive projects other than that gender needs to be destroyed. And without having an actual positive project or praxis, just kind of falls into hoping for an insurrectionary break or a systemic break at some point.
I also think the tension with bringing gender nihilism into, like, our gender resistance work is, like, I don't want to call them campaigns, but most resistance against gender violence, you know, relies on us talking about trans people, talking about women, talking about people's genders and the violence they experience based on people's genders. So, like, gender abolition is rejecting all of that, which is important, but the tension is we need to, like, validate people's genders and the gender violence they experience while still fighting towards a totally genderless world.
Okay, so a little bit of a left turn. What is the gender nihilist analysis of Trump's recent threat to ban trans people from the military?
Gonna need a second.
So, the gender nihilist analysis on Trump's threat is just laughter?
Kind of, very much. I think that there's a lot of...
that's the best way
you
to
can
put
sort
it.
Of, you could sort of root the discussion about the concept of transgender people in the military through various ideological channels, even broader than our specific channel of gender nihilism. I think that, you know, I mean, obviously, as all, you know, anarchists, we would just... you know, root away from the military immediately, and then when you get down farther into other ideological channels, it's just kind of like, oh, I took care of that ages ago. I don't know if there's a more interesting critique or analysis anyone wants to put forward, but...
I mean, I feel like laughter does it well, but I'll try. So, there's no one gender nihilist position, and I can't really stress that enough other than that we all desire the abolition of gender and, like, the destruction of, like, us being categorized and limited. But I see the Trump ban, the Trump trans military ban, purely as just a deepening of the sands of gender, as in it's increasing the control and domination and limitations based upon gender, saying trans people can't exist in these spaces. Not that we really want to be in the military or contribute to the imperialist death machine, but it does have negative aspects for our brothers and sisters and whatnot in the military actively. And really, it's not a step towards abolition. It's just a step further in the process of gender, continuing the violence and cyclical violence of itself.
Some people have floated the idea that this was some sort of that Trump was testing the waters for further crackdowns on trans rights. I'm doing lots of air quotes here that you can't see because this is audio. But I think that's one, giving too much credit to the president and his use of Twitter. I think realistically he was probably just saw something on Fox News and just tweeted it. But I guess the sort of broader rollback of trans rights, if you want to talk about maybe a better area where you can sort of talk about this kind of stuff would be the battles over bathroom bills and all that stuff. It is this sort of
easier topic than the ban.
Yeah, that's an easier topic, but I think it kind of points in a sort of similar way, where it's the sort of move towards the entrenchment of the categories of transness or cisness. And obviously, as gender abolitionists, we are playing this kind of game where we're obviously, most of the people in this room right now are trans people, but we are still dedicated to the abolition of gender, which includes the abolition of cisgender and transgender as categories.
And the destruction of man, woman, so forth.
Alongside all those categories. That's not you just destroy those two categories. No, you have to destroy the broader category before that of man and woman. But I think that, obviously, seeing these kinds of codifications of, who can use what bathroom or whatever, is this sort of moment where it is kind of this, it's putting it into words, it's putting it into laws. And you look at, you want to go back to Foucault's whole history of sexuality and the invention of the category of the homosexual with, anti-sodomy laws, or is that what he connects it to?
I believe it's been a minute since I've read Foucault.
Yeah, it's probably something like that. But it's a similar sort of thing where it's, this sort of, I'm gonna keep referencing Foucault because I like Foucault. That being studied is the first step to being controlled. Being sort of recognized, not necessarily. Well, recognition is a form of control. That is kind of acknowledgement is a form of control. And whether that acknowledgement is a positive thing, if for whatever reason, the liberals over in California decided to pass a bill explicitly naming that trans people could use the bathroom according to their gender. One, that's a weird fucking law to pass, but two, that's an entrenchment of the trans identity within the code of law, whereas our, ultimate political mission is the abolition of gender.
And Amanda touched back and expand the question earlier about what is intelligibility and unintelligibility, and it's recognition. The state being able to recognize and define you is intelligibility, and being intelligible or recognizable is part, or one of the key parts, first parts of being governed.
So you've already mentioned and discussed this over the last 20 minutes or so. But I just want to ask if there's anything you'd like to add to the tension between, on the one hand, the desire to abolish gender while also recognizing the validity of violence towards women or trans people, for example, given that gender abolition does have this mixed history of being transphobic from some perspectives, obviously not yours. But is there anything else that you'd just like to add concerning this tension?
The tension between desiring to abolish gender while being inclusive, what we're getting at?
Uplifting variant genders, I guess.
We see a lot of gender abolition, it sometimes gets tied to the trans exclusionary radical feminist stream of thought, to sort of use that acronym.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I think that we should probably talk about. Do you want to lead on this, Lena?
You can start. I'm finding quotes.
Okay. I mean, that it is sort of a... on the surface level, you do see that these are both two goals that each sort of movement would espouse. You know, they were both sort of supporting the abolition of gender. I think a big distinguishing point that you see between them, and this is just going to get like purely mechanical, is that the radical feminists would preserve the categories of sex and just sort of create, I think, probably an equilibrium between the sexes, whereas we said, and I think I haven't read Judith Butler. I'm going to out myself as that right now. I still haven't read Judith Butler. I'm fucking up by now.
Call out.
but I believe Lena on Monday when we were discussing and sort of playing for this conversation, you mentioned Judith Butler saying that sex and gender are essentially the same at this point.
Gender or sex is already gender.
Sex is already gender. Is that right? So I think in our analysis, we would say that we are. Not just gender abolitionists, but also sex abolitionists.
Mm-hmm.
In a way. But
you can go first if you want.
Yeah. As for like the ideas of inclusion versus abolition, mostly ripping off of the Gender Nihilist Anti-Manifesto, that we should desire to be inclusive, but it shouldn't be our end goal, and that we have to be honest about the limits of our politics, and like. Be honest about the limits of our praxis and the way we go about things. And, like, inclusion is not going to abolish, but abolishing is like not really a far off goal, but not an immediate goal that would leave many people at risk, many trans people who like occupy the like intersections of oppression and domination and whatnot, and just leave them out to dry, just like waiting for the day whenever things are done. So,
yeah,
like, we don't necessarily oppose inclusion. We don't necessarily throw our full force behind it because forcing inclusion via like expanding of gender identities, whether it means like expanding the notion of what a woman is or like putting non-binary markers on driver's license and birth certificates and whatnot, it doesn't abolish gender or stop gender, but doesn't necessarily mean it's inherently terrible. But we have to have that critique that expanding gender is not going to end the blood. It's not going to stop the blood from flowing.
I can quote Foucault again, but I already did.
To quote the Gender Nihilist Anti-Manifesto, infinite gender identities create infinite new spaces of deviation which must be violently punished. Gender must punish deviance, thus gender must go. And that, like, we could be inclusive all we want, and it's good in the immediate gains of our comrades and many of our friends who are at risk of the violence of gender, but it doesn't create that overall systemic change and just expands the capabilities and capacities of power to contain and limit us. Insofar as that, like, yeah, you can have non-binary on there, but now, like, the state gets to define what non-binary is and what qualifies as non-binary, who qualifies, like, what aesthetics, what cultures, whatnot, like, get to count for this. So it just gives power more free rein to act as it will.
Yeah. I was just going to say that I think the reality is that like the validation of different genders and like progress in quotes towards like more equal or inclusive spaces, I should say, is like a necessary thing when working within these like the confines of like society and the state, but like is absolutely not enough. And like Lena said, it's just reiterating gender. But we can't reject all types of like gender inclusion because then we just like stay fucked opposed to
it would be leaving our comrades behind.
Yeah.
And like we may not see like inclusion as the end all, but we may see inclusion as the expansion of the capacities of power to control and limit us. It does provide immediate gains for our friends and loved ones, and like will potentially help them get out of like the risk that they currently inhabit live in. Our comrade who doesn't want to be on the podcast just gave us the idea of wanting to abolish homelessness and like seeing that homelessness is this horrid like set of systems that leave people fucked, leave people without the abilities to live and like continue on their lives and fulfill like their desires and whatnot. But we also have to build houses, or, like make ways for them like to be able to live. And like, yeah, say, like, not that I'm, or, sorry.
Well, the example,
like, squatting a house to make, like, a collective housing for, like, say, however many homeless people to live in won't end homelessness, but still a positive idea to follow through with.
And practically speaking, inclusion implies a scale much larger than I'm interested in. I'm interested in organizing around shared experiences of violence and shared temporary expressions of identity that make sense for a certain organizing context. Anything that, like, sets a specific identity category to organize around or a specific experience that's held in common to organize around that's permanent, I'm not interested in. Anything that's short-term and immediate, something that my friends and I are all involved with or experience together, and we can identify ways to work around it, that doesn't require the language of inclusion. It requires a shared context and a shared expression of self. That is temporary. That's all I'm really interested in doing.
So I would like to change directions here a little bit. You talked about identity politics before. I would be interested what your perspective of identity politics is and what an anarchist critique of identity politics would entail.
Would you like to expand on what you mean by identity politics, or would you like us to define what we mean by identity politics? Because it's a very loaded term, and everyone in the left use it as like pejorative or something to like throw your entire weight behind or whatever. It has a lot of meanings depending on who you ask.
Yeah, I would like to hear your definition of identity politics.
I would... think for a second. I feel like identity politics is the attempt...
How do we go about this? Well, it's so expansive that, yeah, you know, those two words together... I mean, identity politics is anything from, like liberals on the internet being like, I don't know.
If you don't show up to the next Black Lives Matter event, you're racist. Even if you have work that night, you're racist.
Yeah, it's anything from that to, like, what we're talking about in a sense, but, like...
I think identity politics is a form of making intelligible, and, like I said, going back to studying, gaining control over, and infinite expanse of sort of experiences and an infinite expanse of different realities that existed for different people. And I think that this is... When I talk to other people about this sometimes, I frame myself as this as being sort of a different... I definitely have framed this and these kinds of beliefs as forms of identity politics before, partially because when I'm talking to someone who isn't familiar with this, it makes it a little bit more palatable, because it's referencing something that's familiar, and it does sort of give them a grounding from where they can kind of jump off and sort of come to recognize that this is sort of a critique of identity politics coming from a place that does share sort of the same, you know, I mean, we can speculate about the goals of different deployments of identity politics. I mean, some people probably are sincere in that they are, you know, attempting to craft, you know, what we would all sort of agree as, like, anarchy land, quote-unquote, through identity politics. But, you know, obviously, like, the liberals on the internet aren't trying to craft anarchy land. But they're still deploying identity politics in a similar way. And so I think that gender nihilism sort of does attack identity politics in the way that it is...
In the way that it attacks all forms of identity, because...
And all forms of politics.
All forms of categorization.
Yeah, and identity is a category that limits us. And identity is a useful category when sectioning us off so the state can understand us and keep us, I don't know,
separated,
understandable,
separated,
or whatever,
understood,
controllable.
Yeah. And then... I would define identity politics in much less terms, just that it's lowest common denominator politics, or like essentialist politics, insofar as that, like, I would say identity politics would be like, oh, all trans women believe this, all Black people say this, and things like that, and it's like, it just tries to get people to rally around extremely basic concepts, and then applies that basic concept to everybody in that group.
Yeah, and it's totally useful by the state, like identity politics, and that's like my main frustration with it, I think.
Like when the state begins to issue driver's license with a marker for a third gender on it,
like in Washington.
Yeah, like what does that mean for us? Like how does the state define this third gender or this, you know, other marker? like, who qualifies for that? How does it define that? All these definitions are going to be loaded in their own way, alongside other axes of oppression, too. You know, we're going to see sort of the same, we're going to see that play out in a way that is, you know, aligned with the other forms of domination in our life, whether that be class, race. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like
all forms of identity are defined by power.
Yeah, and like Lena said, also categorizing us based on gender or race, like, effectively separates us from each other and, makes it harder for us to unite against the state and the identities that are, you know, keeping us in chains or whatever.
Like, organizing with other trans people, like, we have way more in common than we do that separates us, but because we tend to view, like, our own individual experiences as their own, like, set of politics that we can't get along. Than like trans men and trans women not getting along because of like drama on the internet or like just the overall politics among the left separating people, or like making them think they have completely different goals when like they actually have completely similar goals but they just use different language.
Yeah,
can I make you mad and quote from the Xenofeminist Manifesto real quick?
As long as it's once.
Okay.
Too primy for this.
This is from
same
work. This is from a work that both of my comrades here obviously have some issues with, but I personally think it has some good in it, entitled The Xenofeminist Manifesto.
From 2015.
From 2015. It's very recent. Xenofeminism understands that the viability of emancipatory abolitionist projects, the abolition of class, gender, and race, hinges on a profound reworking of the universal. The universal must be grasped as generic, which is to say, intersectional. Intersectionality is not the morcellation of collectives into static fuzz of cross-referenced identities, but a political orientation that slices through every particular, refusing the crass pigeonholing of bodies. This is not a universal that can be imposed from below, above, but built from the bottom up. Or better, laterally, opening new lines of transit across an uneven landscape. This non-absolute, generic universality must be guarded against the facile tendency of conflation with loaded, unmarked particularities, namely Eurocentric universalism, whereby the male is mistaken for the sexless, the white for the raceless, the cis for the real, and so on. Absent such a universal, the abolition of class will remain a bourgeois fantasy, the abolition of race will remain a tacit white supremacism, and the abolition of gender will remain a thinly veiled misogyny, even, especially, when prosecuted by avowed feminists themselves. And so, I think that really kind of is a, this is obviously is not exactly a gender nihilist piece, but I think that the gender nihilist approach to identity politics is, I would say, relatively in line with this.
They're related insofar as they're both gender abolitionists, while gender nihilism specifically doesn't promote any positive projects, while xenofeminism tries to map out a way to get out. Which is why xenofeminism is like a manifesto, where it tries to set out a program and praxis, while gender nihilism itself is just a set of critiques. It's a fantastic set of critiques, but cannot escape just being a critique.
But I would say that they share this particular critique of identity politics, more or less. I mean, obviously,
the
as
critique
we said
of
earlier,
universalism, the critique of, like, universalism, essentialism, limitation, and whatnot.
Yeah, it's very much in line with each other.
I would like to hear the critiques people had of that manifesto, if there's more than what you just mentioned.
So, we're looking for critiques of it now in all the books we have in our beautiful InfoShop basement. But my critique of the Xenofeminist Manifesto is that it does seek to abolish gender insofar as that, like, in name, I guess, and, like, wants to abolish gender as a set of categories, but doesn't attack the categorization of sex. There's a quote in the Xenofeminist Manifesto that's a
let
100 sexes bloom, which is still 100 new categories, or like 100 or so categories that people can be limited to and confined to, and it's like, yeah, cool, like, now we get limited by sex and not gender. Yay, we're free now. Oh, cool, and I get to take hormones whenever I want. Like, that's not freedom. Freedom is not being limited based upon what you do, and also having the capability of doing what you want.
Xenofeminism is relatively connected to the sort of gender hacking that I mentioned earlier. There's a decent amount of cross in between those two sort of ideas and this sort of, I guess that one of xenofeminists' praxises would be gender hacking. And I think, you know, earlier I mentioned there was, you know, sort of gender nihilist critique of it, that it was, even though it was, you know, sort of this personal seizing and ownership of gender. It was still an acknowledgement and a acceptance of gender and sort of a self-imposition of gender. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can make an argument that that is a pathway to abolition, but I think that the gender nihilist would argue that that's not a pathway to abolition. More along a mechanical line than anything. That's just not going to work.
Because it doesn't destroy the structures of gender. It just, like, expands them and makes them more inclusive. Like, say, like, the whole gender hacking thing. Like, letting people take hormones and, like, you know, like, design and create themselves as they see fit. It's so... That's good, but they're still limited and doesn't get rid of the structure that defines them by that. And say everybody has access to, like, testosterone and estrogen and whatnot. That's fantastic. It'd be pretty cool to be able to buy estrogen at Walmart and, like, the gun section and all that. But it's not going to make you free. It doesn't mean freedom because things are still being sold. Things are still being defined and, like, the structure and base of it all is still there. And that is more of an accelerationist route, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you're trying to paint your house red with a lot of blue paint.
Yeah, on Monday when I was reading the Xenofeminist Manifesto, we were sort of talking about it as a form of gender accelerationism.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off with the... it says that, you know, the path to freedom is through alienation. You know, the path to freedom from gender is through gender alienation, which is something I think that we would... sort of disagree with as gender nihilist. We would say that no, that's just the path to alienation. The path to freedom from gender is destroying gender. You know, alienating yourself from it doesn't change the structural reality of it. It doesn't change the fact that it's still a thing that's being, you know, put on you from the top down.
Yeah, like trying to expand it till it breaks versus I'm just gonna hit it until it breaks.
Yeah,
it's kind of
difference. and that's exactly like what we said with like let 100 sexes bloom. You know, I think Xenofeminists would probably argue that, you know, that they are in favor of the abolition of both gender and sex as we are, but that, like Lena said, it's the expansion until it breaks versus the actual just breaking of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the argument then becomes, like, how resilient is gender? Can it just expand infinitely or will it break at some point? And I think gender nihilists would probably tend to say that it can expand infinitely or it can expand a heck of a lot. More than we're aware.
I have some pretty, as fortunate as it is to say, I have kind of strong faith that power and governance has ways of expanding itself and being malleable to the point where it can just
assimilate us and every different expansion and categorization mm-hmm. into control by the state.
Even if, like, we define the category ourselves, like...
I have a quote that I was actually just reading from Baydon. It's kind of relevant, I think. Whether in the form of gay assimilation, identity politics, or radical queer subculture, any contemporary engagement with queerness must reckon with decades of capitalist integration into society and its state. These varying forms are joined together through positive queer identity as a shared content. If we read Edelman with a great sense of catharsis, it is because his conception of negative queerness allows us to discard all the identitarian baggage which accompanies queerness. This move against a positive queer project is a crucial one. It illustrates one truth about capital. Capital is predicated on accumulating value, any value, for its own self-reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the expansion of identities and identity categories just expands the capacity of value. So, like, with the whole, Washington allowing non-binary identities onto driver's licenses... Like, yeah, if that continues going, like, that just means that you now have, like, a boys section, a girls section, and a non-binary section when you go shopping for clothes.
Yeah.
Totally. Which, like, it just means that there's a new market and a new way for capital to keep going.
Yeah.
It doesn't put any wrenches in the gears. It doesn't slow it down. It's just like, oh, cool, children get to feel included, which is great, but capital still exists. And those kids are still going to be alienated and unhappy when, like, they go to work and go to school and just experience power in any other way.
Totally. And just to finish that quote, there is no positive queerness that isn't already a site of society's reproduction. So, it's like...
Queerness already has its own market.
Exactly. To our horror, queerness becomes the avant-garde of marketplaces and the dynamic lifeblood of advanced postmodern economy.
Mm-hmm.
To finish the paragraph. So, yeah.
We're now at the point where they're going to be selling hormones, like, at stores, but they are going to, like companies are going to compete for who's more inclusive and whatnot, because, like, being inclusive is now, like, a factor in market play.
Support LGBT causes, but buy Doritos.
Yeah, buy Doritos, go to Target, you know.
Rainbow capitalist
officer's hand.
Yeah, shake the cop's hand, get, like, rainbow stripes on cop cars and all that garbage.
To 1 second, return to the Xenofeminist Manifesto. Is it the one by Laboria Cubonix?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but yeah.
Well, I have bad news for some of you. The What is Gender Nihilism reader has deemed it canon.
The, that book from Eberhardt, the, that black cover book?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it right in front of me, too. There's a few things in there that don't really fit into gender nihilism, but, like, it is a good base for it and, like, to have critique of it. Because, like, or, like, in the inspiration section, there's, which one was it? I think it was, like, the woman-identified woman, and there was, like, one or two other pieces that were technically, like, turf writing or, like, trans-exclusionary radical feminist or trans-woman-exclusionary radical feminist. Just because, like, it is the basis for gender abolition. So, like, xenofeminism fits into gender nihilism that, like, they overlap in that they want to abolish gender, but they go about it in completely different ways. I feel like it was included to show, like, to critique of it and, like, the interplay of discourse about gender abolition coming about in 2015 or so, whenever, like, it was acceptable for us to talk about abolition of gender among the left without being accused of being a TERF.
And, I mean, like we said at the beginning of this interview, you know, there's a lot of different gender nihilisms, and there's a lot of different...
yeah.
And, you know, there probably are some gender nihilists who would, you know, say, who would be more amenable to the Xenofeminist Manifesto than Nina and Elias are. I'm slightly more friendly to it than either of them, but in fact, we can get into those issues later.
Yeah, gender nihilism relies on, like, a radical negativity, and that's what separates it.
And Xenofeminism, like, is sort of, it does have this kind of it has a negative futurity. Like I said earlier, it has this sort of... I mean, I think that if we want to go back into... I'm sorry, I was reading Edelman last night. But so I think that, like, you know, the gender nihilist typically does include the sort of rejection of futurity, but I think that Xenofeminism, you know, it says in one of the very first paragraphs of the piece, what is it? It says, we are... XF is not a bid for evolution, but a wager on the long game of history, demanding imagination, dexterity, and persistence. So XF, the Xenofeminist Manifesto, is, you know, sort of saying there's a future here. There's this futurity to it. Mm-hmm. Whereas gender nihilism,
sees the
us as gender nihilists, at least, because, like you said, this is in the reader.
Yeah.
You know, and there are probably gender nihilists who do like this and who would agree with that line from the Xenofeminist Manifesto, but the people in this room would probably reject the sort of the vision of the future, the futurity of. Whereas even though Xenofeminist is, you know, nihilistic in some way, it does kind of hold on to the future.
Yeah,
we don't.
A key part to, like, the gender...
We don't Elias, though.
Yeah,
I kind of do.
The key part of, like, the gender nihilism anti-manifesto is just, like, how there is no future. And, like, that means we have to do away with gender now and find some way to have an insurrectional break with gender, because there is no potentiality of it getting better. Like, the whole critique of, like, how expanding gender identities isn't going to, like, end gender, or how, like, expanding of technology is not going to end gender. Now we're just kind of seeing it get more and more entrenched. And, like, as time has gone along throughout the entire history of gender, it's just gotten worse. Or maybe not necessarily worse, but has, like, expanded its capabilities of limiting, confining, and whatnot. So without, like, any sense of future, all we have left is, like, that radical break, or that radical negativity, that radical critique, the radical negative critique of gender.
Yeah.
It's like, there is no future to posit. Like, we don't know what a genderless future looks like, and it's no real point in playing, like, making a thought experiment of, like, what kind of utopia is without gender? Like, we don't know. We don't have time to play these games. Like, we gotta get free.
Okay, so let's say someone is hearing about gender nihilism the first time via this interview.
Sorry.
What would you suggest if they want to learn more about gender nihilism, if they want to abolish gender? There's the What is Gender Nihilism reader, which we just mentioned. Is there anything else?
So the What is Gender Nihilism reader is absolutely fantastic for this and includes most of the writings that I would think of to include, like the Gender Nihilism and Anti-Manifesto, Gender Nihilism by Aidan Rowe, which is available online. It's on her WordPress, whose name is slipping me right now. There is the set of journals called They Dawn, the first one being a journal of queer nihilism, the second one being
a journal of queer heresy, yeah, the third one is a journal of queer time travel.
Yeah. And that, like, They Dawn kind of set the stage for gender nihilism and did gender nihilism before the Anti-Manifesto without, like, having the term gender nihilism. In that, it's more of an expansive critique than just an Anti-Manifesto. It's, like, an entire set of books digging into what gender is, what queerness is, and how do we get out. For just gender abolition in general, I cannot recommend Monique Wittig enough. She wrote One Is Not Born a Woman back in, what, the 1980s. It's included in the What is Gender Nihilism, a Reader. But, yeah, from 1981. But it sets, like, the stage for gender nihilism because it is a radical break from gender abolition beforehand, being, like, the whole third wave TERF gender abolition towards an understanding of, like, the material basis of gender and, like, the consequences of gender for everybody, not specifically people who fit into the category of woman. I think I have a list of other things, too. Oh, and I have to plug myself with my writing Destroy Gender on Filler PGH, the WordPress. And, and then, like, there are writings that are not specifically gender nihilism, like the ones we just listed. Like, I mean, like, Wittig's not specifically gender nihilism, but, like, Wittig, the Lies Journal, which is available from AK Press, is, like, it's a compilation of gender abolitionist thought that's not rooted in, like, 1970s feminism and tries to go further. Like, there's an essay in the first one that tries to take gender abolition from the 1970s, strip it of its biological essentialism by, like, using its critiques on its own to show that biological essentialism is not possible with gender nihilism and turn it on its head.
No Future by Lee Edelman is not gender nihilist, but it's queer nihilism, and I think that, we sort of started referencing a good bit towards the end. At least, like, my last sort of spiel about futurity wasn't a large part influenced by a few chapters from that book. And I think that I think queer nihilism and gender nihilism have a lot of interplay, and they both sort of reference a lot of the same things. And, like, yeah, the notion of futurity is very important to both of them and the sort of projection of that. I would argue. I would actually probably argue that they're almost identical, but that's a whole other.
And another book that's pretty essential to gender abolitionist thought, or at least contemporary gender abolitionist thought, would be Judith Butler's Gender Trouble. Although more academic than some of the writings that we've listed before, and, like, people just getting into this may have trouble with it, which is why, like, Wittig is a better introduction to things. Like, they may run into problems like reading Baydon as well, but Baydon cites itself highly. So, like, you don't have to read Edelman to read Baydon, even though Baydon highly bases itself off of Edelman.
The first one's almost entirely
critique of Edelman. Yeah, the first one's mostly just Edelman.
But you can read Baydon.
Yeah, and then Baydon 2 is based upon Freddie Perlman, mostly. Yeah. Or at least, like, Against the Gendered Nightmare is mostly Perlman. But not necessary to read Perlman to understand what's going on.
All right, is there anything else you'd like to add to the discussion?
One thing we should and could talk about is the relationship between colonialism and gender. A lot of contemporary feminist thought believes that gender was spread throughout the world and, like, brought to, like, non-European countries via colonialism, and that it was only through colonialism that gender and gender binary existed and forced these categorizations. And on the one hand, that's right, but it also is completely wrong.
It ignores a lot.
It ignores all the entire history of colonialism. It's like, one, how did, like, if the expansion and, like, overall, like, how do I want to put it? Not the expansion of gender, but, like, the increasing of gender's, like, power capabilities, the increasing of gender throughout, like, the non-European world is not strictly based upon colonialism. Like, pre-colonial societies have their own conceptions of gender. it may not be as violent and as horrifying as, like, the process of colonialism forced on many indigenous societies, but gender existed before colonialism. It's like, how did Europe develop gender if it wasn't colonized? Like, it had to have come from before that. And at least from my perspective, gender as an apparatus came about with the division of labor and the separation of, like, productive labor versus reproductive labor, or housework versus, like, farming. If you want to say farming itself is, like, the basis of the division of labor. And that saying that gender could only go throughout the world via colonialism removes agency from non-European peoples and whatnot. Basically tries to claim that only colonialism did bad things when, like, hierarchy existed before colonialism. Like, they didn't just invade, like, anarchistic people or people who are already free and made them unfree. Like, they already had their own civilizations and societies and divisions and separations. And it may not have been, like, a gender binary. They may have had them in three different people or three different categories, but that's still three categories that people were forcefully assimilated to, either, like, through social conditioning or violence in one way or another.
I'm glad you brought that up.
It's something that really needs to be talked about, because I've noticed that a lot where, at least among left-wing circles, that, like, before colonialism, everything was fine, and, like, colonialism's what made things go to shit. And, nah, kingdoms, fiefdoms, hierarchy, and all kinds of slavery.
It's the noble savage, man.
Yeah. I mean, slavery and whatnot existed before colonialism, and all these horrors existed before colonialism. It's just that colonialism did it, like, quote-unquote, better. It streamlined it and made it more violent and more efficient in what it does. And, like, yeah, colonial gender needs to be abolished, but gender can exist without colonialism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, what would you say to someone who says that gender abolition is a colonial thing, in a sense that it also desires to abolish pre-colonial gender conceptions?
One thing is that, like, they're already assimilated into colonial genders. Like, you're going to be hard-pressed to find somewhere in this world that has not been colonized. Like, Great Britain and Spain have conquered, in their heyday, conquered pretty much every part of this world and instituted their own concepts of gender and race and hierarchy and class and whatnot to these societies. As for gender abolition being colonialists trying to abolish non-colonial genders, you have to ask, like, why are you so tied to, like, older forms of hierarchy? Like, yeah, it's cool, but, or, like, yeah, it may be interesting, like, you may have a cultural connection to it, but, like, why are you so connected to being, like, dominated by your own people? Why would you want to be controlled and limited by your own people, if you even have, like, your own people or see them as your own people?
So you could almost tie it back to identity politics, which we discussed earlier, where it's more about the identity and representation and hierarchy rather than abolishing hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, most places in the world had some form of hierarchy.
Pre-colonial contact.
Pre-colonial contact. And I think, like, you know, yeah, that's... this. Yeah, it's, you know, you can try to, you know, if you're going to buy into that argument, then you're probably also going to have to buy into the argument that any form of radical thought is colonialism, in that it is an idea being exported. But I think that kind of idea has been sort of thoroughly rebuffed several times throughout ideological history. And it's you can make the same argument about a bajillion different, you know, sort of emancipatory projects as being colonialism in disguise, because they're coming from somewhere else and they're not respecting this kind of past. But it's, I mean, like, you look at that, that's pretty much the noble savage myth, and that's not what we're about.
Although Rousseau did nothing wrong.
All right, Lena.
Yeah, getting into the whole, like gender existing pre-colonialism, like, there's an essay in What is Gender Nihilism called Romanticizing the Transgender Native, which is all about how, like, I guess, I forget the specific terms they use, but it's like how like white and modern day transgender people see themselves as like a trans historical class, including like indigenous third genders and indigenous third genders, indigenous like non-binary genders, and tries to connect themselves to that and like follow that whole trend while not acknowledging that like it's not free or better or liberated. It's still three categories. I forgot what I was trying to get at with that. It's like, there's a long history of like trans feminism and just radical feminists trying to base trans liberatory thought or gender liberatory thought on indigenous cultures, and trying to say like, oh, like the Lakota had three different genders, so three different genders is the way to go and will make people more free, give them more categories, while not realizing that people are still stuck into three different categories and are forced into those different categories. And like the third category is only conditionally accepted based upon its usefulness towards society and not free or, not free on its own or capable of doing what it wants. So like the Lakota had three different gender categories, the third gender category being like analogous to like modern day trans women, but not being trans women because like they have different sets of discourses and technologies about them.
Yeah.
But the third gender is only conditionally accepted because they can perform like certain roles within rituals, but like outside of rituals are still excluded and kept separate.
Okay.
And it's not liberatory. It doesn't end the fact that people are separate. It's just like, oh, cool. Like non-white people did it. So that means it's okay. And great. Yeah, and appropriative to like try to tie ourselves to this historical concept of transness that doesn't exist, that only came about like within European society with like different medical discourses advancing.
Yeah, I think the relevance of examining third gendered societies is that with knowing that third genders exist or different types of gender categorization exist in like earlier or indigenous societies, we can see that like genders only exist in our society as like a part of society's usefulness, if that made any sense.
Mm-hmm. Gender itself is constantly based upon productive and reproductive labor, and that in certain areas it made sense to further break down.
It shows that two genders doesn't actually exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that in European society it became expedient at some point to only to maintain the strict binary division. It was just expedient for production and reproduction based on whatever the material conditions were, and that in other parts of the world, when there was the process of colonialism and we sort of started to ethnographize these people, the people around the world, there were some places where the material conditions in the history required made it expedient for society to maintain different gender constructions, but that was still gender was still there, and like we've said a bajillion times now, we're about abolishing gender. Mm-hmm. We don't want a third gender, we want no gender,
we want to abolish like categories,
yeah,
or like limiting categories. There's nothing inherently wrong with categories, but it's the fact that people get stuck in a specific category forever unless they make drastic changes. And those drastic changes being, like, life-threatening or just, like, life-threatening.
Yeah.
Do you have any last thoughts to add?
No real last thoughts on the discussion, but we do want to say check out fillerpgh.wordpress.com for our writings and, like, updates from the Pittsburgh anarchist scene and all the stuff that we've been up to.
Mm-hmm. The youth scene.
Yeah, the anarchist student youth scene. Although most of us are like graduating. You're young, I'm old.
I'm still in school. My voice crack?
As for parting thoughts, I speak as an individual and not on behalf of the Failure Collective, but I think it would be fantastic if It's Going Down had a comment section. I've had a lot of my comrades like tell me that they really wish It's Going Down had a comment section so I didn't have to go to Anarchist News to talk shit. And they could just do it right on the site.
All right, well, I'm going to resist the temptation for my hand to slip and delete this part of the recording. All right, well, I just want to say thanks, y'all, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for me too. It was a really informative discussion.
And I'm sure It's Going Down is going to replace this with a proper conclusion to the podcast.